Whew. Your fan mail is done.
The envelopes are stuffed. Card, headshot, and sticker?
Yes. It took most of the day.
All signed on the parchment paper, modified calligraphy, authentic but still readable?
Yes.
Two pumps of Bulgari cologne, not too perfumey, still masculine?
Yes.
Okay, heat the wax and I'll get my stamp. Oh, OMG! What is this? What is this?
It's your signature. You said the sign love mark.
No. The A. Look at the A. It's supposed to be a heart.
Oh, I forgot.
This is so cold and unfeeling. I want it to be warm and inviting. You'll have to do these again.
Mark, it's midnight.
You better get started.
This is going to take ages.
Yeah, it's going to take all night.
I don't want to do this.
The following podcast contains graphic descriptions of international celebrating and global merrymaking. It may not be suitable for angry or unhappy audience members. Listener discretion is advised. You've been warned.
Have you ever seen any of those foreign films? I don't like them.
Some are born great, others achieve greatness, and some watch Christmas movies.
For Natale! God is helping!
We are the wild and crazy guys!
Well, they're both festive, aren't they?
Walking across the floor. I love counting to the number four. Oh, you're counting with me to one less than five and one more than three. Whoa, oh, we're counting to four. Whoa, oh, let's count some more. Counting to four.
We are the Festive Four and Film Fans. Well, howdy, Mark.
Hey, welcome to Season 4, Bob.
Season 4? Can you believe it? It's the fourth year. We would be almost going to kindergarten.
Some people think that's the maturity level we have. It's very appropriate, Bob.
I was thinking about it, and 4 has very cosmic significance. Now, 4 might seem like a very simple number. But if you look across all of our civilizations, 4 has been a symbol of so many things, of stability and structure. Like, think about how the world organizes itself into groups of 4. You have the 4 seasons, 4 elements, the 4 directions, the 4 phases of the moon. And then break it down. This shows you even how more powerful it is. Science reinforces the significance of the number. In mathematics, 4 is the first composite number. 4 is the first perfect square. Physics describes the universe through 4 dimensions. You have 3 dimensions of space and then the dimension of time. You have biology. Our heart has 4 chambers. Many of the animals, 4 limbed. Now, if that hasn't caused you to get a little freaky, think about this. Even religion displays the symbolism of 4. So you start with Christianity. Christianity is anchored by the 4 Gospels. Judaism, they celebrate the 4 sons during the Passover Seder. Buddhism teaches the 4 Noble Truths. And Hinduism is built upon the 4 principal aims of life.
Wow.
I know. It's spooky and amazing at the same time. And think about what we do, Mark. We cover the 4 corners of the globe.
Bob?
Yes?
That seems like an oxymoron. 4 corners of a globe?
Of a globe.
Maybe that's what we are.
We're oxymorons in need of kindergarten education, starting with what's the globe? So you can see that the gravity of this significant anniversary year has not been lost on me. So, Mark, I decided to do what I think any rational adult would do in this situation. I thought it was too important that we just leave our fourth season to chance. We needed some professional advice. So I went and sought out a numerologist.
I don't even know what that is.
This is a certified numerologist, and I found her online. She had crystals, candles in her office, so I thought that was appropriate. She has the necessary tools, and I could see that she had a degree in applied decimal mysticism. You're speechless.
I can tell.
I explained to her the concept of our podcast, that we've been at it for 3 years and we're going into this most important fourth year. And so she stared very thoughtfully into a snow globe. And this is what she said to me. Four symbolizes strong foundations, and the universe loves balance. As long as you continue celebrating Christmas with curiosity, kindness, and an unhealthy fascination with obscure foreign Christmas movies, the number four will smile upon you. So whether you believe in the power of numerology or the magic of Christmas, the universe is telling you something. After 4 years, avoid scheduling major life decisions during Mercury's retrograde, or it will create negative holiday energy. You got that?
No. That sounds like we better be careful what we're doing then. If we don't watch our retrograde, something bad could happen. Now, I don't even know what a retrograde is, but I'm going to Google it later to see where exactly it is on my body.
I was hoping you could point it out for me.
No.
There, you're sitting on your retrograde, and it's getting wider in the speed.
Exactly.
Because the last thing I want to do is create negative holiday energy.
Right.
We do not need that. After 4 years of this, you know, it's no crazier than some of the other things we've heard.
True.
By the way, the fourth anniversary gift, traditionally, is fruit and flowers, or if we're looking at the modern list, it's appliances.
Oh.
So, look at this. I got you this Ninja Blast portable blender and some frozen strawberries, so we can celebrate with smoothies.
Aren't you supposed to give your anniversary gifts after you've completed 4 years, not as you enter the fourth year?
Oh.
I hope that wasn't the retrograde that you just abused. I mean, I think we'll make it through 4 years.
Wow, I'm not respecting the retrograde. I mean, I can pack away this Ninja Blast, but those strawberries are going to look pretty bad in a year.
We'll throw our retrograde to chance, and then we're going to go for it.
Now I realize after this discussion, kindergarten, here I come. I'm ready. We're going to go into our new show, but before we do, we have one last gory detail of administrative housekeeping from season 3. It seems like such a long time ago because we've been time traveling, swimming, and doing all kinds of fun stuff that it's hard to remember back to when we were in Panama. But the end of season 3, we discussed a riot.
Yes.
We offered up our own engineering marvel of a prize if you could tell us what an American stole in Panama City in 1856 that caused a 24-hour uprising that killed 17 people and left 63 others wounded. Now, that's the sort of cliffhanger that really sticks with you. So I know everybody has been on the edge of their seat thinking about this throughout their summer vacations and all the things they've been doing. I know you're thinking, this has to be one really valuable item. And what has to be one of history's most astonishing overreactions over the theft of a single watermelon helped ignite what is now known as the Watermelon Riot. It was an international incident with multiple casualties. And if you knew this answer, we'd offer up an amazing, colorful square of sticky paper that's developed with a precisely calibrating balance of adhesive chemistry, flexible materials, and molecular bonding. Yes, you can have a 4F sticker to start the fourth anniversary of our show.
Wow. Bob, I have to say two things before we get into tonight's movie. One is, I have to tell you that the Watermelon Riot, if you have 15 minutes, go and look this up. And it's not even over a whole watermelon. It was over a slice of watermelon. The U.S. citizens and the Panamanians were not getting along. There's a lot of tensions. And when the fight broke out and people were shooting each other, the Panamanian police joined in and started beating up the Americans too. So this is history. And you should all thank Bob for making us smart, because this is going to show up on Jeopardy someday.
Well, and you know, at some point, someone's going to go, yeah, remember the watermelon riot? And you're like, yeah, I do. You know, a whole watermelon, that I could support a riot in. But a slice? That's crazy.
And the other thing I'd say, Bob, as we enter our fourth year, there's a website called millionpodcast.com. And they recently put a list out of the top Christmas podcast, and these podcasts are ranked based on their Apple review, Apple and Spotify ratings, monthly listeners, activeness, subject expertise, and overall authority within the niche. And thanks to our fans who listen and download and follow us, we were ranked number 19 out of the top 50 podcast.
Mark, I'm blushing.
It's really our fans who listen in. And if you're curious, well, are there only 50?
No,
there's over
a lot more.
100.
Yes.
Christmas podcasts that are just based in the U.S., let alone internationally. So thank you to all our loyal listeners who download each month and listen to us. This year, 19. Next year, all I can say to deck the hallmark.
We're coming after you.
Oh, let's get season four kicked off, Bob.
Yes, we should. So, Mark, we're going to visit, and I was trying to think what we'd call them. Are these our step citizens? So what do you call fellow citizens when your president goes and takes out their president?
Right.
We're on our way to Venezuela, so I guess we're visiting our step family.
Yeah, I like that. I think I would go with step family.
We are off tonight to Venezuela.
Want to watch a Christmas movie?
Christmas movies are our bread and butter.
We eat Chinese food and watch Christmas movies.
I heard it's the best Christmas movie since Home Alone.
We watched a movie called Yotama Se Ve Valdando from 2003. But let's first talk about two of the actors in the film. The first one is Beatriz Vasquez. And Beatriz, she played Yotama. And Beatriz grew up in Caracas, but moved to Spain for 4 years. When she returned to Venezuela at 17, she finished high school at a convent. There, she developed a passion for art, but she chose to major in education at college. And at college, she had a specialty in physics and mathematics and a major in literature. But while she was studying there, she was selected to participate in the National Theater Workshop. And at the end of 3 years, she had appeared in several plays and decided to begin her film career. She said, you know what, physics, mathematics, nope, I'm destined for the stage. She was named Best Film Actress by the National Association of Cinematographic Authors, but she is best known for her role as Rita in the telenovela La Viuda Joven, The Young Widow. So she is our main actor here. And then also there is Asdrubal Melendez. He plays Emilio. Asdrubal Melendez Luco is a Venezuelan actor who has worked in many branches of the arts. Not only is he in theater and film and television, but he's also a visual artist, a set designer, a poet, and a teacher. Mark, every one of our episodes, we get shamed by the fact that we have one talent, which is not understanding most things in life. Our friend Asdrubal, he graduated as a sculptor from the Academy of Fine Arts in Prague, and he put on a number of exhibitions. He was also a professor at the Libertador Experimental Pedagogical University. He has starred in over 60 feature films and received the National Film Award in 1992. In 2020, he was declared a Heritage Bearer of Venezuela and received the Francisco de Miranda Order in its first class, and he also received the Rafael Briceño Award, special mention 2024.
You look at him, and he just looks so distinguished. All those things you just read. Yeah, that sounds right. He's so distinguished looking.
I felt like the character he was playing was kind of like he was in real life, especially when you read he was a sculptor and he received all these awards. He just seems like just a classy guy. Let's got to dig into this movie. So, Mark, this is kind of an interesting movie. It's one of those ones where I edited it with thinking, how do I feel about this film? Maybe Mark can help me sort through my feeling. It's interesting because it starts out, it's showing some home movies of a wedding, and then you see this couple with an older man, and they're walking down the streets of Caracas, and they're on their way to a restaurant. They see an accident with an ambulance. They go to dinner, and while they're at dinner, a robbery breaks out. They crawl under the table, and the robbers are telling people to take off their clothes and give them all their valuables. And then the police show up, and while the police are fighting with the robbers, one of the robbers climbs under the table, the same table where this couple and the older man are at. The robber, who proves to be a woman, decides she's going to sneak out with this couple and this older man and takes off her mask, has a gun, and so they all go out, they go past the cops, get into a car. She's trying to figure out what to do, and she decides to go to where the couple lives. Then there's an interesting scene where there are some Santa Clauses on the street, and they clearly look inebriated, and then it turns out to be they were trying to rob the people in the car. And they get away and the shots are fired. But it kind of seems that the film is also making an indictment on the crime level in Venezuela or the poverty level. Did you feel that too?
Honestly, I did not.
Okay.
No, I didn't. It's an interesting observation. I think the early stuff that you're describing, right, is spot on, right? I mean, she clearly is clever. She's smart. I mean, it's interesting your point you bring up because here they are in the midst of a crime and then someone tries to carjack them.
And they had also showed like there had been an accident or something on their way to the restaurant. And then later on, the older man, Emilio, as he gets to know and wants to get to know Yotama, he makes a comment during a conversation and he says to his grandson that we're hypocrites. And kind of almost defending the fact that Yotama was robbing them and taking the prisoner. But for the life, the benefits that they got in life, they could be her too. That was essentially almost the message I was getting from him. They go to this apartment, which is fairly large. He says it, he calls it a hangar apartment. But the interesting thing about it is it's all one giant room with screens, right, dividers in there. But what I also found is, and slightly uncomfortable at various points, the couple is having sex, and you realize that there's just these little screens set up that are separating them from the rest.
There's some very interesting things that happen, right? So they go back to the grandson's place. It's a big place, and Yotama screens herself off, and then everyone else is free to do what they want to. There's parts of it where it's like, well, gosh, what if I was in that position? If I was Yotama, am I really going to let them do what they want to? And then Lucia, very interesting time, decides she wants to have sex with her boyfriend. Why, there's a woman with a gun next door.
And his grandfather is singing
and his grandfather,
at the piano. What is funny about that, Mark, is, and you kept thinking, couldn't you escape? Wouldn't you run out? Or later on, there's one point where they start making food and there's knives there. Now, Yotama does realize, oh, the knives are dangerous and takes them away. But they had been sitting there for a while. She goes to sleep at various points. It is kind of interesting. You think that they could perhaps escape, but she does have a gun and she is threatening them. She does hit Lucia, but Emilio really comes to want to understand Yotama and what has motivated her. And he opens up to her. He wants to know about her life, and he opens up to her about his life. And one of the things that comes out in his discussion with his grandson was when his wife died, when Emilio's wife died, he was lost and he took off. So he abandoned his daughter, who was his grandson's mother, abandoned them. Not in terms of financially, he sent him money that his grandson said, we always had money, but we didn't have you. And I missed you. You weren't in my life. Obviously, I think the grandfather is experiencing the guilt over having abandoned his daughter and then ultimately his grandson. And we see various things that will happen in any hostage situation. The grandson tries to go up on the roof and get the attention of an apartment across the way, which actually proves to be kind of funny because as he's waving to them, they're celebrating Christmas. And I guess I should say this is all taking place at Christmas time. So there is a tree, there's lights, and they're dancing, and he's waving to them, and they're waving back, celebrating. Yotama calls someone on the phone, and ultimately we learn it's her daughter. So she struggles with that.
I think the father of Victoria was actually out of the picture because when Pepe, it was the grandfather, right? They come Pepe, yeah. Papa. When he was talking about mourning his wife when she died, you remember she sort of is touched by that and said, wow, no one's ever loved me like that.
Yes. And we see that she is missing her daughter. There's one point where she's trying to watch something on TV and cartoons are on there and she's crying. And even Lucia's like, she attacks us like a crazy person. Right. And then she cries during cartoons.
Right.
In the conversations that the grandson's having with Pepe, he is blaming him for all of this, for everything. And I think that's still some of the ragged feelings he had about his grandfather and having been abandoned. But as we learn more and more about Pepe and his wife, and he's opening up and he's asking Yotama, that's how he learns about her. He learns about her daughter. She starts to describe how difficult her life has been. And she makes the comment, when I could still dream. And she describes how when she was 11, she was raped by four men, one of which was her cousin. And then she makes a comment that, oh, it was actually five men, really, because of the police officer who right. she reported it to. It's just horrible. She calls her daughter Victor, as in victory, but she's like, how can I even say Victor? I can't even provide for her. That's why she went along with this robbery. It was her first one, and obviously became a huge issue. And the relationship between Yotama and Pepe is evolving.
They're certainly getting tender. I wasn't sure where it was going to go. There was certainly a loving relationship that developing.
Yeah. It is very tender. And she looks through the pictures and they touch. There's a lot of touching, and but it's innocent. And to your point, she makes the comment, no one has loved her this way. And he's showing her a tremendous amount of attention.
In fact, like at one point, she falls asleep and she wakes up and Pepe has taken the gun.
Yeah.
The gun that Yotama has, he's taken the gun. He gives the gun back to her.
He gives it back. And
then he gives the bullets back too. Yeah.
He said, this may be crazy.
And so I think a chemistry was definitely building.
And at first I thought it was his intention was try to win her over for her to let them go. But then he had the opportunity with the gun. There was another incident where a neighbor comes down because he hears him yelling. And then Pepe kind of covers it up and makes a cover story like they're having a fight in there
right.
about a misunderstanding. And she even says, what is your intention? Why did you do this? And he said he wanted more time to get to know her.
The grandson set off firecrackers to try to make noise to hopefully someone would call the police type of thing. And Pepe totally just covers it over.
There is also a handheld video camera. That was kind of the home movies at the beginning. There's various scenes where they're showing through the video camera. And then there's a dream sequence. And
if you could see my notes from the movie, I'll read it verbatim. Dream-movie-scene-WTF is that, quote unquote. I didn't get it. I watched it again, and I'm like, what am I missing? The only thing I could come up with is that where they sort of trying to stage what a perfect relationship would be. I couldn't come up with anything meaningful for that.
In some ways, I was enjoying the film, and I wouldn't say it derailed it, but it dropped in out of nowhere, and I really appreciated how the relationship was building between two lonely people opening up to each other and then sharing. The daughter does come. Pepe goes and gets the daughter. And I, right. He's outside. He could have stopped a copper, but he goes and gets the daughter, brings her back. What I find kind of funny about this is that you would almost think that they would want the daughter to be charming and cute and lovable and everyone would fall for her, but she's not that at all, which if you think about it, in I think the conditions as she's grown up in, she wouldn't be, and so it's more realistic, but she curses, she makes fun of the adults when they're trying to tell her to behave herself, she's mocking them. She's
quite precocious.
And so ultimately, it comes to a head where they're all dancing, and then he goes to sleep, and in the morning, when Yotama goes to wake him up, he's died. He has died. And that leads into, they take care of him, they get him cremated, they have a Christmas dinner. He filmed himself before he died, and he leaves messages for Lucia and her grandson and Yotama and the daughter. And then they go out to spread his ashes where fireworks are going off. So clearly it's either New Year or it's Christmas at that point. And Yotama eats some of his ashes.
Yeah.
The buildup until this dream sequence. Then after that, some of it I didn't get or was a little over the top. His scenes with his messages to each one of them were very touching. But that whole ending part with them having the Christmas dinner together, when she had been their robber who had taken them hostage, they weren't really warm with her or her daughter. They were trying to get out. And then suddenly they're dining together and sharing his spreading of his ashes. It got a little far-fetched, I guess, for me at the end.
I mean, there's a couple things about the movie. I get the whole thing where, okay, she's a robber. They're back there and she's back after she's holding a hostage in the apartment. She clearly is not a hardened criminal. No. She's never robbed anybody before. She went along with her boyfriend to do this, seeking love. And so maybe she connected with the wrong guy. The other thing that I found a little weird too was, when Victoria comes over, Yotama talks about how she was sexually assaulted when she was 11. She comes over, but then Pepe takes Victoria for a bath.
Oh, yeah.
Victoria is naked. Why would you let this strange man
that you barely
take your
know,
naked
yeah.
daughter into a bathtub? And then at the very end of the movie, Victoria has a gun and she's putting it in her backpack.
Oh my gosh, I forgot that. Yeah.
I literally got anxious when she had the gun. I'm like, going to shoot herself. She's going to shoot herself. Something bad's going to happen here, and it never does. I was really trying to understand up until the point she eats his ashes, which I think I sort of got and said, okay, she wants him to be part of her.
Yes.
Why maybe a different way of doing that? It sort of all fell apart at the end and stuff. So there's times when it really piqued my interest and I was sort of leaning into the screen, watching and listening, understanding. There's other parts where I was just like, ugh.
There were elements of it I liked and I knew they were meaningful, but there were parts I felt like, am I missing something here? Is it going over my head or is it a cultural signpost that because I didn't grow up there, I don't get? Some of it was washing over me and I'm like, I don't know what's going on. Well, Mark, How about it? Was it Christmassy?
No.
No. You know, it was funny. I was anticipating. This was one of those films where I'm like thinking this question in my head. Okay, there's a tree. There's lights. There's fireworks. People are celebrating. I didn't feel 1 ounce of Christmas at all.
There was a single tree with 13 lights on it, Bob. I counted. Yeah. No, I'm just lying.
Well, it's one of the rare ones. We can have one of our films where you don't see much in the way of decorations or anything, but they feel incredibly Christmassy.
Yeah.
And here's ones where at least there's probably some kind of Christmas thing almost in every other scene, and I didn't feel Christmas at all.
Nope.
How did it make you feel?
Again, at times, my interest was piqued in it. But I would say, if I had to pick one word, confused.
Oh, you stole mine.
Oh.
I was like, I was going to go, no, that's exactly right. I was like, well, and again, there were parts I did get sucked into it. And some of the dialogue and the conversations were good. The other thing, too, is were they trying to cover too much ground in just a handful of days to make such a significant connection like that?
Right.
It wasn't like they were hiding out for months or anything together, you know. Would you watch it again?
Nope.
Yeah. The one thing I was intrigued by is I kind of liked when they were walking down the street. And if they spent some more time in Caracas and I could learn more about Venezuela, I would like that. But it was all in one apartment. So, yeah, I'm not interested in seeing it again, and I don't think I would recommend to anyone to watch it really as well.
In our four-year history, this is in no way the worst movie that we've reviewed. I just couldn't really connect with it and figure out where to go with it.
There's a lot layered in here, so much so that, like, you brought up two things that should be significant things that I completely overlooked or forgot. The bathtub scene with the daughter and the gun. Both of those, the gun in her backpack, had all the notes. I didn't even think about those. So, you know what, Mark? As you saw, and I think I saw it up on a couple of signs in their apartment, it said, Feliz Navidad. We know how to say Merry Christmas in Spanish, as they say it in Venezuela. So the question is there anything else that they say at Christmas in Venezuela? And Mark, there is.
There is.
You want to hear it?
I would love to.
Que vivan las gaitas, which literally means long live the gaitas, which you're probably like, who's the gaitas? Yeah, and why are we wishing it long live?
I don't even.
It's not a traditional Christmas greeting like Feliz Navidad. It's an expression celebrating one of Venezuela's most beloved Christmas traditions, gaitas. And it's a form of music. And it comes from the state of Zulia. And so the gaitas are recognized, they're very synonymous with the Venezuela Christmas season because you hear gaitas music played on the radio during the holiday season. They play it at parties. You go to concerts to hear it. The Venezuelans will say, hey, que va vivas la gaitas, you know, during the holiday season. It's an expression of joy and celebration for the music, for the traditional festive music. You can hear it shouted during a party or at the end of a concert. Sometimes it's used on social media because this gaita music is playing everywhere. It's kind of like if you were to say, here's to the holiday season, joyful rallying cry about celebrating the music and celebrating the spirit rather than a greeting for the holidays.
Is gaitas like, so we have rock and jazz, soft rock. Is gaitas like just a style of music then?
Yeah, exactly what it is. And it's a style of music that for some reason is usually played quite a bit during the holiday season. So it's associated with it. They actually have a Venezuela radio station, an online station called Que Viva La Gaita Radio. So it's devoted entirely to gaita music. They frequently will use that phrase. So let's go through some of the traditions, always very interesting traditions. The first one is, even though in Venezuela, many of the families, they put up a Christmas tree, what is more traditional, though, is the nacimiento, which is the nativity scene. And some families create even more. They call them pesebres, which are a whole diorama. So not only do you have just the manger and the Holy Family, but you'll have shepherds and the kings and a town and the mountain and the sheep. And they make a huge tableau of mountains and fields and valleys. And these pieces are often family heirlooms, and they're passed from generation to generation and a special part of the holiday. What I found so interesting is the nativity scene isn't just a decoration. It's yeah. often where the gifts are delivered. So if you think about it, in the U.S., your gifts are under the tree. Santa right. comes and brings the gifts and puts them under the tree. Since the traditional gift giver in Venezuela is Niño Jesús, baby Jesus, the children often will find their presents gathered around the nativity scene instead of under the tree. And so,
cool. Jesus is the reason for the season.
Absolutely. And so, whereas our kids in the U.S. will write letters to Santa, they write letters, the kids in Venezuela, to the Christ child, asking for their gifts. When they go to bed, they can't wait to get up and check out the nativity scene. This next one is kind of funny. I suppose it's not so funny that the Venezuelan president, Nicolas Maduro, who did this, is now on arrest here in the U.S., but as things in the economy and with his administration and things started to get worse and worse in Venezuela, what Nicolas Maduro started to do is, let's start the Christmas season earlier than usual.
Great idea.
It was a decree from the government. So starting in 2019, first Maduro said, let's start the Christmas season in November. And that meant put the lights up, turn them on earlier than they normally did. Then in 2020 to 2023, which in that point, it's also a pandemic time, he announced again early Christmas celebrations. Sometimes he'd say October, sometimes he'd say November. He was trying to promote joy and optimism during these difficult economic and political times. And then in 2024, he said, okay, officially, Christmas is starting on October 1st.
So, not a bad guy, really.
I just think it's funny that the government comes out and says, okay, Christmas starts October 1st this year, and you got to put up your decorations, have concerts, have festivities. And then even in 2025, did the same thing, October 1st. And he said, look, in 2024, it was good for the economy, the culture, and public happiness. Now, it didn't change, the legal holiday stayed the same, but
right.
again, he just encouraged the municipalities and the businesses to begin decorating and holding these Christmas-themed events to boost morale to distract from his political and economic problems.
Hey, if you can't fix it, distract, right? Like, look over here. Look at my right hand. Look what I'm doing.
So not that I ever fight with my wife, but if I were to fight with my wife, I think the next time that may occur, I'm going to declare we're going to start celebrating Christmas.
You know, Bob, we have a couple extra bedrooms here, so that doesn't go the right way.
I may show up with like lights and a tree. And now this next tradition I've actually heard before, and I was curious. I'd seen it on lists. You know, sometimes you see these lists of the craziest Christmas traditions throughout the world. And this one comes up a lot, and I was curious if it was really true. And it is, although in some ways it's on the wane, but I'll explain what it is. In Caracas, they have a tradition called Las Patinatas Navideñas, which means Christmas skating outings. And this began in the 1950s when, during the days leading up to Christmas and on Christmas morning, families would put roller skates on and head to church. It became so popular, this tradition, that streets were closed to traffic in the mornings so people could skate safely. And they put on festive clothing, and people would be out handing hot chocolate. And over time, as it evolved, it started with roller skates. It went to rollerblades and skateboards. And they'd say, oh, yeah, they roller skate to church. And I'm like, do they really do that? Well, they do, and they still do it, although the reason why the tradition has declined, and it's sad, it like reached its peak in the 80s and kind of has declined since then, and it's only because of more crime. Crime has risen dramatically, and so it's popular because of that. However, what they will do is, where it was much more freeform before, now they'll organize these pettinatas, you know, to take place at certain times so people would get together and still go roller skating.
Yeah, that's too bad. I really like the concept behind that.
I love the concept of roller skating in church. But then there was part of me thinking, so then are you sitting through mass and your roller skates and do you skate up for like communion?
That would be fun.
So Mark, here's now onto the fun part, the eating part. So what can we have in Venezuela? Jalacas. This is the quintessential traditional Christmas dish in Venezuela. It's cornmeal dough filled with rich, slow-cooked stew, which is usually a mixture of beef, pork, and chicken. So all of them together. It's seasoned. These are the seasonings. Onions, peppers, garlic, capers, annotto oil, olives, and raisins. They have all these savory-type flavors, and then, boom, there's a raisin in there. So then you take all this, you wrap it in a plantain, a banana leaf, you tie it with a string, and you boil it.
You kind of lost me at boil.
I know.
Everything else sounded good.
So the jalaca is more than food. It's a symbol of Venezuelan identity with the country's flavors reflected in the dish. So that's their main one. But then they also have the pan de jamón. Pan de jamón is another iconic Venezuelan Christmas dish. And you know what this is? Ham bread. It's like a slightly sweet yeast bread, and you have a filling with ham, green olives, and yes, do I say it again, raisin. You got me with the ham and the green onions, and then I was maybe hoping for some bacon or something, but they tossed in the raisins. But there are some variations where they will include bacon and cheese and almonds, but the typical is you got green olives, ham, and raisins. This was created in 1905 in Caracas. The original loaf really just contained leftover pieces of ham that were baked into the bread. It was like kind of to take the leftovers, what could we do with them? We'll bake it inside this bread. But then the popularity grew, and so the bakeries began adding raisins and olives. And what people will say, it's a combination of sweet, salty, and savory, which I like. You know, I have to say, I'm not a huge raisin fan. I try this one. This one I try.
Well, you know, I actually do like raisins. I have those little box of raisins that I take on a plane and eat them when I'm like reading or whatever.
Then you'd embrace this. You'd love it.
I would try it for sure. I would say, I don't know if it fits what I would typically see in a recipe, but maybe that's what would make it good. I don't know.
That's what would make it good.
I would try it.
For dessert, we'll have dulce de lechosa, which means green unripe papaya. So you take the papaya, cut it into thin strips, you simmer it for hours in cane sugar syrup. Then you flavor it with clove, cinnamon, and sometimes citrus peel, so it has a rich caramel flavor. This has roots in their colonial heritage, so probably brought to them by the Spanish. It's papaya in a caramel type flavor. I'll take that one too.
Yeah, for sure.
And then finally, Mark, I have to tell you, this one I think is kind of fun. This is in the Andean region of Venezuela where the Andean mountains are. They have this unique tradition among the Gauchos people, and this tradition is called Paradura del Niño. It's a ceremony honoring the Christ child. And so the name comes from, you have to stand the baby Jesus straight up in the nativity scene. During Advent and Christmas,
okay,
the figure is, you know, obviously lying down. But during the Paradura, there is a theft of the baby Jesus. So he's taken. The ceremony includes a playful dramatization where someone secretly removes the figure, and then the family members have to search for him. And then when the baby is found, they return him in joyful procession with prayers and singing, and he's placed in the nativity, but lifted to that standing position to symbolize Christ's presence. Some of the guests will even sing in front of the nativity, and he's taken out, and each party goer will kiss him. So that's one that we could adopt. Maybe we'll take one of your kids, and they could play the baby Jesus, and we'll stand him up.
I tell you, like, you never know where we're going to go. This is kind of a cute tradition. I think it's very tender.
I like it. You know, we're going to turn to Christmas music.
This calls for some Christmas music.
Yes, this Christmas music.
What kind of Christmas music is that?
The least you could do is play some Christmas music.
And now back to Christmas music.
So, Mark, the song that we have for tonight, it's a pop interpretation of one of their traditional Christmas songs, kind of like Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer.
Right.
It's the song El Burrito Sabanero. You know it.
I do.
I've heard it before as well. And I know that some people, this is in their canon. They play the song. It's very lively. And the song was composed in 1972 by a Venezuelan composer named Hugo Blanco. And so the first recording was by Simon Diaz. He was with the Venezuelan Children's Choir. And that's probably the most famous one. If you've heard of this song before, you've probably heard that one. And then there was one the same year, again, another children's group called Ronda Lalita. They recorded it as well. Both of those are very common. This one is by Juanes. He recorded this as a modern Christmas single, and it's kind of fun because he added electric guitar and some upbeat production to kind of modernize it. So it still has that childish appeal. It's kind of like taking Rudolph. Some of the rock stars will do it. It kind of makes it a little bit fun. And the whole story is about someone who's riding a donkey, that's the burrito, and following the star to Bethlehem to see the baby Jesus. And the lyrics describe the journey. So not only in Venezuela, but pretty much in Latin America, this is just as recognizable as Jingle Bells or Rudolph. It's a standard that you'll hear the kids sing it in schools and choirs. It's really been recorded a number of times by very, very many artists. It's even included among the list of Billboard's 100 greatest holiday songs.
It's a great choice. I think the first time I heard it, many, many years ago, our HR director bought us a Christmas CD of songs from all over the world, and this was on it.
Well, Mark, we're off to our new segment.
Yes.
Jingle bell, Belgium. Jingle bell, Belgium. Jingle all the way.
Why would I go to Belgium?
Belgium, Belgium. In your face, Belgium.
After that, you might be asking yourself, why the heck are we spending an entire year doing a deep dive on Belgium? I mean, Belgium. What have they done to deserve this level of attention from the festive foreign film fans? Did Belgium save Christmas? Did they invent Santa? What? Well, we say, have you ever seen Belgium? Because it may be small in size, but it is enormous in personality. It's an overachiever, as Mark clearly underscored for us when we voted on our best items from season 3, and Belgium proved to be our overwhelming favorite because they love beer, and they're famously known for having a little boy peeing outside as a statue. They have waffles. I mean, come on. Does this remind you of anyone? If Mark and I aren't the human embodiment of Belgium, then we will eat our luxurious Belgium chocolate-covered hats. We like to think long-term here, and so we want to spend an entire year just shamelessly praising the birthplace of Christmas beers, because we hope that it'll pay off eventually. Maybe the Belgium Tourism Board will hear about us. They'll invite us over for a tasting. And of course, we'd have to accept such a gracious gesture. Just in the name of international fellowship, Belgium brews more Christmas beers than any other country, with flavors like cinnamon, cloves, star anise, orange peel, caramel, brown sugar, and cherry. And these beers are usually stronger, with an ABV of 8 to 12%.
Shoof.
I always thought they were just those dark Abbey stouts, but no, they have a whole variety of styles, and we're going to discover them because they have festive blonde ales, they have barrel-aged specialties, they have even the world's premier Christmas beer festival. The Kirsbier Festival in Essen has the largest selection of Christmas beers anywhere in the world. Now pinch me, Mark. I think I've fallen asleep, and I'm sure you may. If we can't finagle an invite to the Kirsbier Festival in Essen, we are not doing our jobs. We are not one to toot our own horns, but we truly believe that every great event can benefit from outside and impartial judgment coupled with extensive experience. I mean, think about it. When it comes to beer, we think we could humbly submit our application. And why us? Because in the Olympics, they don't let a country award itself medals. They let the professionals do it. So two American Christmas podcasters who know far more about drinking beer than about brewing it, we are experts. We think this is like a public service that we are offering to the country of Belgium. It is a burden that we're more than willing to shoulder. And, of course, we'd have to bravely sample the 200-plus Christmas beers. It's why we are there. We're not saying this is a calculated attempt to court Belgian hospitality. It's truly not. We would never think of something like that. We aren't trying to seek a free trip or to be the parade marshals or anything. We just want an official beer festival glass with complimentary free refills.
Well, those other things wouldn't be bad.
Of course not. We would graciously accept them.
Absolutely.
You know, we would just hate to disappoint such a friendly country if they were to offer us. So
we would like to be your ambassador, Belgium.
And at first we thought that Belgium might not have enough activity for us to study for a year. But even though this country is the size of Maryland, think about it. They have three official languages. They have the Smurfs. They have Tintin. And they have castles everywhere. Plus, there's In Bruges, the movie that was filmed in Belgium. Bruges glows in the film with its lights, horse-drawn carriages, snowy canals, and festive squares. And then you add the two hitmen, a medieval city that looks like a fairy tale, and a foul-mouthed dwarf. Come on, what more could you want from a Christmas film? It's a favorite. We're going to talk about that. I mean, Belgium might be small, but it is packed with fascinating history, culture, and quirky facts. And we think of it like Europe's greatest stocking stuffer. So, at first we thought there wasn't going to be enough. Mark, how are we going to cover this all in 12 months?
I agree, Bob. You know, and that's even two shows a month. How are you going to cover it? I don't know. I think the Belgium Office of Tourism should be bracing for this onslaught. This is huge. This has so much potential.
I think the breweries right now are setting out like tip glasses to bring Mark and Bob to Belgium right now, and they're just collecting money as we speak.
Maybe we can fund some t-shirts for them to walk around and just generate some public, some social media outcry to get Mark and Bob to get us over to Belgium.
Make Belgium more festive. The festive foreign film fans.
Hey, Belgium, listen, you beat the U.S. in soccer. By the way, officially, Bob knows this. I was cheering for Belgium against my own
country. He was. So, this is our new section. It's Jingle Belgium.
It's trivia.
Trivia. Now, Venezuela, things just seem to be naturally bigger. Take, for example, the Angel Falls. We thought maybe we'd ask you how they have the tallest waterfall on Earth in Venezuela. This waterfall is 2.5 times taller than the Empire State Building, and it's so high that the water evaporates before it even hits the ground.
I'm not smart enough to understand that.
Then we thought maybe we'd quiz you about their legendary Goliath bird-eating tarantula. This is the king of spiders. Its leg span is nearly a foot, and it is eaten there as an exotic food or a local delicacy. They roast it on an open fire after they pluck out its irritating hairs.
Not just any hairs, just the irritating ones.
Yeah, the ones that are red. Or how about another giant fact? Scientists discovered fossils of giant prehistoric guinea pigs in Venezuela. These were the size of antelopes, and they're known as the largest rodents ever. And finally, we even considered asking you about the Venezuelan named Cezan Orlando Rodriguez Hernandez, and he holds the Guinness World Record for the largest feet on a living person. His feet measure over 16 inches.
Oh, my God.
So think about this. Venezuela seems to have a policy against moderation. The waterfalls are taller. The spiders are bigger. The rodents used to be the size of furniture. And even the feet are above average. But we're not asking about any of those things. We're interested in something else. The Lake Maracaibo River Basin in Venezuela, where something occurs there, of course, more than anywhere else in the world. It occurs 280 to 3,600 times in an hour for up to 10 hours straight and 300 nights a year. It is called Relámpago del Catatumbo. It's the everlasting storm. But what is happening there? If you know, we have something that is bound to infiltrate laptops, car bumpers, and unsuspecting water bottles. It is a little piece of adhesive on a coordinated mission that requires speed, strategic placement, careful targeting, and precision. No helicopters, no special forces, just one sticker and the hope that our 4F mission will have a lasting impact until everyone knows about the festive foreign film fans. So, Mark.
Yes.
I have a quote for you.
I want to hear it.
Peace on earth will come to stay when we live Christmas every day. You can recite that in a sing-song fashion for yourself while you brush your teeth. And that is by Helen Steiner Rice. Next episode, we're going to take on a doubleheader. We're going to explore whether one child's Christmas in Wales is simply enough, because we're watching A Child's Christmas in Wales and A Child's Christmases in Wales. But beneath these nearly identical titles, you will find two very different interpretations of a Welsh family. Both of these films can be found on YouTube, Amazon Prime, and Tubi TV. And one more poem for you. Here's to Venezuela's flame, its festive heart, its cherished name. May peace and kindness always stay, and Christmas light its passing day.
Love it. Was that just a four-line poem, Bob?
Mark, it was. That has cosmic significance. I think our Mercury retrograde just hit the globe, the four corners of the globe. So I think we got to take shelter.
I think we better run, Bob. I'm heading for my bomb shelter in my backyard.
Good night, Mark.
Good night, Bob.
Actually, we're done.
Done.
It's over. Over, over. It's over.
It's over. Kaput. Finito.
It's over.
And sound engineering on our show is by Jake Fontana.